Our next speaker is Professor David Owen. David Owen is Professor of Social and Political Philosophy at the University of Southampton. His research interests are very broad. They include problems of political community, contemporary democratic theory, the ethics and politics of migration, theories of power and freedom, and the works of Foucault, Wittgenstein, and Nietzsche. His books include Nietzsche's Genealogy of Morality and Nietzsche, Politics and Modernity, a Critique of Liberal Reason. And David's talk today is titled Subjects of Justice, Subjects of Inclusion, and the Critical Theory of the Public Sphere. Please join me in welcoming him. Thank you.
Thanks. It's extremely nice to be here to discuss Nancy's work. Although I would like to start by thanking my mother, who, since my wife is currently in Montreal, is enabling me to be here by looking after the children, which task I go back to this evening. Okay. The critical theory, as Rainer Faust has remarked, the question of power is the first question of justice. This is so because rather than adopting what R.S. Young famously called the distributivist paradigm, critical theories of justice take the primary focus of justice to be the relations of persons and how they're structured by relations of power. This focus on power, in conjunction with the commitment of critical theory to taking the distinction between persons seriously, requires that principles of justice are vindicated democratically. Thus, the minimal conditions of justice are those required for good enough democratic deliberation on principles of justice. In tying justice and democracy together in this way, the issue of inclusion is not an additional or external issue in relation to justice, it's normatively central to any critical theory of justice. Moreover, as Nancy Fraser's recent work on the politics of misframing makes manifest, this issue of inclusion is also central to contemporary arguments and practical struggles concerning justice and democracy in a globalising world. Now, Fraser's approach to the issue of misframing is conducted through an attempt to revise the classical theory of the public sphere, which has been central to Habermasian and post-Habermasian critical theory. So I'll begin by just quickly sketching that issue for Nancy's work before focusing on two questions. First, the issue of inclusion, of how one conceptualizes inclusion, what principles of inclusion should be endorsed. And then second, the theoretical framing of the issue of inclusion in terms of public sphere theory. And in that second part, I hope to connect up also to some of the work that Nancy has been recently doing on Polanyi, some of which you would have heard in the lectures. So just briefly, concept of public sphere as a critical idea refers to a space in which public opinion is mobilized through informal deliberation as a legitimate and effective political force. In the classical theory of the public sphere, publicity is supposed to hold officials accountable and to ensure that the actions of the state express the will of the citizenry. That publicity is primarily understood in terms of this role, arguably made a certain degree of sense against a somewhat idealized picture of governing constructed in terms of the constitutional democratic state and the relationship of state to civil society, in which it was assumed that those affected by or subject to the domestic laws and policies of the state were legal members, i.e. nationals, of the state, while the issue of those affected by foreign policies of states tended to be something about which the public, classical theory of the public sphere, had little to say. Yet today, as Fraser acutely notes, neither this picture of governing nor its blithe assumptions concerning those affected or subjected can be maintained. Consequently, in taking up the question of the place of a critical theory of the public sphere in relation to the increasingly transnational contexts of contemporary political life, Nancy Fraser acknowledges the need for a reformulation of this view. One fundamental part of that reformulation concerns the issue of inclusion.
You know, in the old view, you just kind of assumed that people, either citizens or those who happened to be on the territory of the state, were the relevant party. When you're dealing with transnational constructs, including the transnationalisation of the state itself, that is no longer an assumption you can make. So you need to develop some kind of account of, you know, who should be included in public sphere, who's entitled to inclusion. Now, given that for critical theorists, power is the first question of justice, it would seem to follow that subjects of power are subjects of justice, a conclusion that would appear to give prima facie support to advocacy of some version of the all-affected interests principle as a principle for inclusion, on the grounds, as Ian Shapiro has put it, that this principle ensures that decision-making tracks power. Fraser, like many others, started from this position, holding that, quote, all potentially affected by political decisions should have the chance to participate on terms of parity in the informal processes of opinion formation to which decision takers should be accountable. However, more recently, she has come to argue that the all-affected interest principle is flawed, leading to a one-size-fits-all globalism which is radically unmoored from any sociological grounding in actual transnational social and political relations in their diverse contemporary forms. Instead of a critical theory on this view, the all-affected interest principle, as developed, say, recently by Bob Goodin, leaves you with an abstract, moralised standpoint. In response, she now advocates a version of the all-subjected principle, which she glosses in terms of the claim that, quote, what turns a collection of people into fellow members of a public is not their shared citizenship or co-imbrication in a causal matrix, but rather their joint subjection to a structure of governance that sets the ground rules for their interaction. Although she also allows that those immediately excluded by a structure of governance can be included in the relevant public, since such exclusion, direct exclusion, you know, directed at particular parties, is a form of being governed. Now, this latter move has led Simon Caney to suggest that Fraser is simply giving a reformulation of the all-affected interest principle, where the relevant notion of being affected is construed in terms of subjection to governmental norms. In contrast, elsewhere I've argued that Fraser here is kind of running together two distinct publics formed by any non-global structure of governance, where the first is composed of those subject to the norms governing who is governed by a particular structure of governance, that is essentially norms of membership of that, while the second is composed of those subject to norms governing how those who are governed are governed, that is, governmental norms of rule within a given structure of governance, not norms of membership. Both of these are potentially coherent interpretations of an ambivalence in Fraser's position. In general, though, I think that there are good reasons for Fraser to make this shift from being affected to being subjected as the relevant criteria for her central interest. So here are three reasons. In its prospective form, the all-affected interest principle does have, to put it mildly, a tendency to be expansive. The difficulty for the all-affected interest principle is that who is potentially affected depends on what we might call the decision space of the polity. In its narrowest construal, the decision space is constituted by the options on the table at a given time between which decision takers are to choose. And so, hence, in a decision context in which there are three mutually exclusive options, A, B, and C, those potentially affected would include all whose interests would be affected by the choice of any of A, B, and C. However, since Fraser's condition of participatory parity rightly requires that those included must be able to deliberate not merely over choices between a final set of options, but also over the agendas within which choices are framed, a consistent application of the all-affected interest principle would require at least construing the decision space of a polity, in terms of all affected by any plausible option that can be chosen under any plausible agenda, which tends to be quite expansive. As a second reason to move from affectedness to subjection, as a principle of inclusion in the demos, the all-affected interest principle conflates a right to have one's legitimate interests taken into account in decision-making with a right to participate in decision-making. Chris McMahon's put the point, I think, quite nicely. The people who have a right under democratic principles to participate in a decision are not those who are affected by it, but those whose actions are guided by it. That is, if the possession of authority is a matter of having a right to direct the actions of some group, democracy is reflexive authority, the generation of authoritative directives by those who will be subject to them. The say in determining a decision that democracy confirms is a say in determining what one will do or allow as a member of the group. And one can make the same point from the standpoint from a view of democracy as group autonomy. When an autonomous individual makes a decision that will guide his actions, all potentially effective have a right that their legitimate claims be taken into account, but the final decision belongs to the autonomous individual. Similarly, when an autonomous group of individuals performs a collective action, those potentially effective have a right that their legitimate claims be taken into account, but the final decision is for the members of the group. And the third reason is that what lies behind this confusion within the all-affected interest principle is that it fails to take being ruled, being governed, as the basic political relation. In making this shift from affectedness to subjection as the salient criteria of inclusion, though, Fraser comes into tension with the commitment of critical theory to the view that subjects of justice are subjects of power, in that what she's implicitly doing is shifting the identity of subjects of justice from subjects of power to subjects of governance. And while subjects of power, governance are certainly subjects of power, it need not be the case that all subjects of power are also subjects of governance. Does it matter that Fraser makes this shift or, as it were, produces this tension? I think it does, because a critical theory of justice is not simply concerned with structures of governance, but also with the production and reproduction and transformation of structures of governance. So how can we resolve the tension? Here I think it's worth noting that with characteristic modesty, Fraser's often tentative and ambivalent remarks on the various principles, as well as formulations of each that seemingly incorporate elements of the others, suggests that she, like so many of us, has been struggling with what may be the wrong way of framing the question, so as to find a single principle adequate to doing justice to the issue of inclusion. To try to move forwards, my suggestion is that we distinguish contexts in which we're concerned with who should be included in relation to a given structure of governance, and questions where we're concerned with who should be included in relation to the institution or transformation of a structure of governance. Earlier, I remarked that being a subject of governance is the basic political relation, as Aristotle famously said. But political relations conceived in this way are not simply given. They're constituted by individuals bringing their relations under a structure of governance. So my relatively simple suggestion is that the all-subjective principle serves as an appropriate principle for specifying inclusion in the demos or public of a structure of governance, while the all-affective principle is the appropriate general principle for determining inclusion within the public of a scheme of power, in which the relevant question is whether to construct a structure of governance. Now, we can come at this issue from a slightly different direction by tending to what elsewhere I've referred to as the circumstances of political autonomy. By this phrase, I refer to those circumstances that generate the need for and value of political autonomy as a distinctive dimension of human freedom. And I understand these circumstances to be composed of the threat posed by two distinct sources of domination, social and political, that arise in relation to individual autonomy. So, I'll address these two types of domination. Conditions of possibility of the first type of domination, social domination, lie in the action and interaction of agents as social agents, and the fact that the practices of social interaction they establish can affect both the autonomy of those engaged in such a practice and, as a consequence of the effects of their engagement in this practice, the autonomy of agents not directly engaged in it. The problematic of social domination arises since practices of social interaction in general can have differential effects on the autonomy of agents, enabling and augmenting the autonomy of some and constraining and undermining the autonomy of others. The problem of social domination arises when those affected by such circumstances of differential affectedness are unable, effectively and legitimately, to act on the practice of social interaction in ways that affect how they are affected. In this regard, all those affected by a given practice of social interaction comprise a social public addressed fundamentally to the question of whether, and if so, how, to govern the practice of social interaction in question. Conditions of possibility of the second type of domination, political domination, are given by the institution of practices of governance, understood as practices of making and implementing collectively binding decisions. The problematic of political domination arises since practices of governance in general can differentially situate those subject to rule as rule makers and rule takers. The problem of political domination arises when those subject to such circumstances of differential rule are unable effectively and legitimately to contest and transform the practices of governments to which they are subject. In this respect, all those subject to rule constitute a political public addressed fundamentally to the question of how to govern their relations to one another as subjects of rule. Now, these problems of social and political domination, which comprise the circumstances of political autonomy, are doubly related. On the one hand, attempts to resolve problems of social domination through practices of governance give rise to the general problematic of political domination. On the other hand, collective political agents act and interact with other agents as social agents in ways that affect the autonomy of agents other than those subject to rule, and hence reproduce while expanding the terrain of the general problematic of social domination. The circumstances of political autonomy thus specify the value of political autonomy as the capacity to set, pursue, and revise ends, where this capacity is situated in relation to two analytically distinct types of context: contexts of social interaction and contexts of governance. Okay, so all that boiled down to essentially is the idea that rather than, as it were, having this widespread ambivalence within political philosophy at the moment, do you go for the all-affected principle, do you go for the all-subjective principle? The answer is you go for both, but they have different roles to play. Now, so this, in a sense, I suggest, would help Nancy to kind of resolve what has been an ambivalent relationship to these principles. What I want to turn to now in the kind of final 5 minutes or so, I guess, is the question of whether the theoretical framing of this issue in terms of the critical theory of the public sphere is a fully adequate framing. And whereas up till now I've just been kind of giving my stuff in relation to Nancy's, I'm now essentially introducing the work of Jim Tully into this discussion. The claim that I'm making here is not that we should drop the critical theory of the public sphere. It is, however, the claim that that theory is partial and limited in the sense of overlooking another important approach to these issues, which Jim Tully's work has recently highlighted. And this is the tradition of democracy as non-violent cooperative self-government, of people exercising the capabilities of self-government together in their social, political, and economic activities on the commons, which is, of course, the classic meaning of democracy, of the demos itself exercising kratos, political capacities, in public reasoning, and acting together for the sake of public goods. Now, ever since Tom Paine initiated the semantic shift of predicating democracy of representative government, this third tradition of grassroots democracy or popular sovereignty has been overshadowed by the kind of dominant Western traditions that took representative government and its institutional structure as their shared basis. Yet, it is Tully's thesis, which I share, that the practice of public reasoning in public spheres with the aim of influencing representative governments is often of limited effectiveness unless it's complemented by and grounded in robust everyday practices of cooperative democracy. And what I want to do now is kind of relate up the introduction of this tradition of cooperative democracy to Nancy's lectures on Polanyi, and particularly the two basic ones of Polanyi's three fictitious commodities, namely labour and land. This juxtaposition is not arbitrary. So for Polanyi, to privatise producing and consuming capabilities, as if they were commodities like any others, disembeds those producing and consuming capabilities and activities from the social relationships in which they take place, and re-embeds them in an abstract, competitive, and non-democratic global set of market relationships. As a result, the exercise of human capabilities in these abstract and competitive relationships gradually undercuts the webs of interdependent social relationships and social capital on which human beings depend for their well-being. Now, from the cooperative democrat tradition, the response to this is not only to exchange public reasons in the hope of influencing governments, it is to refuse to cooperate with this undemocratic and unjust mode of production and consumption, to withdraw one's producing and consuming capabilities from commodification, to exercise productive and consumptive capabilities in common in democratically run cooperatives that are re-embedded in the surrounding social relationships. Such grassroots democratic co-ops then produce and distribute the basic public goods that are privatised under the dominant, as it were, representative government form of democracy, capitalist democracy. So food, shelter, clothing, healthcare, clean water, security, and so on. Indeed, of course, it was just the injustices generated by the privatisation of labour power that gave rise to an important tradition of cooperative democracy in Europe, in which figures like Robert Owen, William Thompson, and Peter Kropotkin played important roles. Currently, we might note, democratic cooperatives of various scales and types have over 800 million members worldwide. If we turn to the privatisation and commodification of land and natural resources, in which the global enclosure of natural resources and biological diversity disembeds them from their interdependent ecological relationships and re-embeds them in abstract competitive global market relations, such that the ecological relationships are treated as externalities, we can see a similar set of cooperative democratic responses to this process and to the consequent pollution and destruction and of the ecological relationships that make up and sustain the natural and human world. This response is, as far as possible, to withdraw their capacities from any activity based on the commodification of the environment and to help develop a responsible way of relating to it. And, of course, for Tully and for many other theorists who have had serious engagement with indigenous traditions, they find within those traditions, as it were, models of responsible engagement with the environment. So the cooperative democratic response does not disregard the importance of public spheres, but nor does it assume it, as much of the critical theory tradition has tended to. In other words, it does not assume that legitimate and effective public spheres are the sole or even primary mode of legitimate and effective response to the great transformation that Polanyi tracked and to which neoliberal globalization policies have both widened and intensified. So, in summary, first part of the paper, I hope to, as it were, continue a dialogue with Nancy and clarify the issue of inclusion in her work. In the second part of the paper, I want to suggest that critical theorists like Nancy and Rainer Forst and others can join hands with, as it were, a non-trivially formal set of agonists like Jim Tully, or as, of course, Mouf and Co. are, as it were, trivially formal, in stressing a tradition of cooperative democracy and grassroots democratic participation, which is out there, but which, as it were, most theories of democracy simply fail to see. Thank you very much.